Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And, of course, we're talking gardening, so it is Monday. But with Dan, we're talking vegetables. And if you'd like to call in with your question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Call in soon. The time always goes quick. 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org and click on the program link to see Access Utah. You can also tweet your questions to us at hashtag AUGarden and maybe we'll check that. Maybe we'll get my first question via tweeting.
It would be interesting. Not being a tweeter myself, I've decided to forego the social medias and just stick with what I know, and that's vegetables. And so, you know, today, Brian, what we really want to do is just talk veggies.
Well, I've certainly been enjoying my asparagus. Good heavens. I think I talked about this last month, but it's still coming on strong.
Well,
and
it
those spears are huge. Oh, my.
That's,
and delicious.
Well, it should come on strong. You know, that's the nice thing about this April-May period is that's asparagus time. Dawn made a beautiful rhubarb strawberry pie for the weekend, so we had fresh rhubarb from that. And then, of course, our tunnel project is cranking out strawberries like there's no tomorrow. And, you know, I think the girls over the last Friday, they picked something like 50 half quarts or something like that. And then they always bring me the culls, which are the ones that don't look, you know, like what you'd expect in the store. And so we sell the good ones and I get the lousy looking ones. But Dawn decided, I'll make a rhubarb strawberry pie. And I was in heaven all weekend because I got to eat about half of it. And I didn't even care. I didn't even feel guilty about it.
So do you put ice cream on it? Or
oh, heaven, yes. It's got to be eggy ice cream because, you know, it's got to have the extra fat that's with it. So then I went for a long walk yesterday. And then I'm out in the field the rest of today because we'll be planting broccoli today. So I'll be on and off tractors and bending over and walking around and doing all kinds of things. So I figured I can, you know, put on a little and take off a little, and I can do it all in a very short period of time. So,
well, since you're talking about going out and planting, let's talk about what can be still put in the ground and what can get started to be put in the ground. You're talking about broccoli.
Most people think
of that as a cool weather crop, so why doesn't that go out any earlier than now?
Well, you know, it's this year, if anyone thinks that this year is a normal year, please think again, because it's not. We normally have frost through late April and early May. We had a hard frost on, you know, Sunday morning here in Cache County and through parts of northern Utah. Last week, we had hard frosts that extended down along the Wasatch Front, and a lot of growers, you know, lost fruit as a result of that. We had over 4 hours of, you know, about 30-degree weather at the Kaysville Research Station, and the young lady that works for me there and takes care of the asparagus research that we have and helps with other activities that are going on at the farm said that she didn't pick any asparagus the rest of the week because it all got frosted. And so on Saturday, I was out at our research plots here on campus with the asparagus, and most of the spear tips had been nipped, and you can see that. They take on this white kind of color to those little triangle leaves on asparagus, which we call bracts. They were kind of whitish, and then you saw some yesterday. I just did a quick look at them because I wanted to see how severe it was, and then we had sunken necrotic areas that were showing up on the spears, which are symptomology of frost injury. And so we get this sense that this year is going to be this extraordinary, special year where I'm going to have all of this wonderful stuff happen. And then nature just throws us another pitch that we swing and miss on, and we get this huge frost that, you know, really sets things back. And so, you know, what's a logical time to plant broccolis and cabbages and those kinds of things? Well, broccoli isn't nearly as hardy as cabbage. So, you know, getting cabbage in late April is not an unheard of thing. But I even don't usually want to put out my broccolis too early, because what happens is they get so chilled if we have these cold, cold nights, like, you know, down to almost freezing or freezing, that the plant stands still for a while. It has to cope with those kind of conditions. And the net effect of that is you just are having plants that aren't growing like you would expect them. And if you would have waited a week or two and planted them out, you know, then they would have just taken right off. And so there's no advantage really in the garden to doing these things too early. And we need to kind of go by the historic long-term kind of average values that we would expect, and that's why we have these recommendations about what are appropriate planting dates for things. So getting broccolis and cabbages and those kind of things transplanted around the last of April, you know, and by that I mean, you know, the last few days of April, the first few days of May, is a good early start for those. And getting them in, you know, this second week of May into the middle of May are appropriate times, because those plants will thrive in the better conditions that we normally have during that time period.
Now, with the latest USDA map, you know, I typed in my zip code, and they're now saying I'm a zone 6. I don't believe that for anything. And it's not a perfect map, of course, because there are, depending on where you are, you could be up on a bench, and it could be a little warmer. If you're down in the bottom of the valley, it could be a little cooler.
Yeah, and we have to look at the air drainage patterns that we have coming off the mountains, and, you know, how you're situated relative to some of the canyons. All of those things kind of change the dynamics of it. And this map, while it's better, is taking into account also what climate scientists are saying, is that we're having this kind of warming period, or so that's associated with, whether you believe it or not, climate change. And we know climate changes all the time, is because I was pretty cold this morning. I thought, you know, the sun's going to shine, I'm not going to put a coat on. And I was like cold walking, you know, to work this morning. And so the map helps you, but it's kind of projecting for the next bunch of years what you might expect to be in your environment. And then you've got the year-to-year variability.
And it's looking also at the minimum temperatures in the winter.
Right.
And this last winter, it was fairly mild here. We only dropped to below zero, I think, once.
Yeah, and that kind of stuff, you know, makes, you know, us think that we can start doing things a lot quicker than we often should. And so, yeah, we're going to get things in the ground. It's still not too late to plant things like lettuce and plant radishes and those kinds of things. Probably a little bit late for peas, so, you know, don't be bothering with that. But you could still plant potatoes if you haven't done it yet and can get seed for them. You know, so all of your leafy greens can go in. And really, at this, as we get later into May, the timing of things, you know, to switch over from a cooler kind of climate to a warmer kind of seasonal pattern that we often see, means that you should probably be buying seed that has a shorter maturity. You know, so you want early maturing stuff so that it rapidly develops, and that helps us. Soils are nice and warm, or, you know, conducive to that. And then we start hearing of people that are saying, well, I'm going to start planting beans, I'm going to start planting corn, I'm going to start planting, you know, seeding my squashes and seeding my cantaloupes and all those kinds of things out in the garden. And now you're running into a risk, because you're dealing with plants that really like it a lot warmer. And yet, you know, there's this risk reward thing that we always like to have. You know, if I only play the lottery, if I didn't play the lottery, I can't win it. So my theory is, if I play the lottery, I have a chance to win, even though the odds are not very good. So, you know, we take that on and we justify what we do. And, you know, when it comes to the garden, boy, it's really nice to have early tomatoes. It's really nice to have early beans and all those types of things. But the risk is that we have conditions like this where it could be going to be quite cool this week, though the forecast is saying that temperatures in the 70s, which would say, maybe I'm going to take that risk because the forecast for the next 7 days is really actually pretty good. Cool mornings, but warmish days. So, you know, let's take advantage of that. And our soils are warming up and they're probably getting close now to those temperatures where we could start thinking about putting seeds in of crops like squash and corn and beans, which like warm soils in order to germinate. They may just be a little bit slower than we would imagine if we had waited until, you know, toward the end of this month to plant those, which would be a more appropriate normal time. But I'm taking the risk this year. And so that's okay.
So I was thinking maybe in about 10 days, well, right now I'm going to put some black plastic down, try to heat the soil up a little bit more, and then in about 10 days I'm going to go out and put some clear plastic. I'm going to plant the cantaloupe seed.
Yep.
And put some clear plastic over that to really heat that soil up and get those seeds germinated and then, you know, pop that off of there. Is that something that's worth doing that way, or is there some way
better? Well, I think if you just do your black plastic thing and just leave that, and then if you put it out this week, let it warm up for a week underneath there, and then just cut a hole where you want to put those plants in and put the seed in there, those plants will push up right through where that slit is going to be in the plastic, and you're going to have what you want rather than taking one off and putting another one back on. So I would do it that way. We already have a few of our commercial farmers that I work with that are putting plastics out in the field. If you're driving out on the highway towards Sardine Canyon, if you look by Wellsville, one of the commercial farmers was starting to lay plastic out there. And if you look at it, it's right on the east side of the highway, just by Wellsville area, if you're in the valley here. And he's been laying plastic, and that's the intent. He's laying it, he's getting ready and warming the soil up underneath there so that he can either transplant his tomatoes and some of those types of things into that environment, or possibly seed squash and seed melons and those types of things. And he's doing it early enough so that you warm the soil up. So your idea of, put the plastic out this week, warm that soil up good, put the seeds in, is a time-honored strategy that the commercial farmers do. Now, I also working with a couple commercial farmers who what they do is they actually create a little furrow, you know, and put the seeds down in the bottom of that furrow and then put the clear plastic over top of it. And so in effect, what they're doing is creating a little mini greenhouse mm-hmm. out in there, because that gap, air gap between where the seed is planted and the height of the furrow creates kind of a little environment that's modified by those warmer conditions and allow the sun to go through that clear plastic. And they already have melons up. There's a couple corn growers that have corn that is up 3 to 5 inches, though they said last week it got hit with the frost a little bit and nipped the leaves on it. And so that was the question now, how much does that set the plant back? And would a field that I hadn't done that to, that I planted a little later, that hadn't been impacted by this cold, catch up with the one that I'm trying to go a little bit, get it to mature a little bit earlier? And that's something that we've been studying, because the farmers are saying, people want corn and they just don't realize how long it takes for corn to come. And so we actually have fewer people gardening, it seems like, because they're ignorant of what's going on. And they just come into the stand and say, I want corn. Why don't you have corn? I mean, I can get it in the store. Why don't you have it? You know, and so you and I laugh about that, but that's the reality of what our farmers deal with in the vegetable business.
If you haven't grown it yourself, you just don't know, I guess.
You just don't really know. And a lot of people don't grow corn in their yards anymore, because if you look at lot sizes and stuff, there's just not a lot of place for the garden. And we know corn takes up a lot of space in the garden. And so they do grow some vegetables. They'll have tomatoes, and they may have some peppers and a few odds and ends like that. But they're not really big into gardening. And those of us that are bigger into gardening, you know, kind of realize, oh, yeah, you know, it seems a little bit ironic that people don't know that anymore, but they just haven't learned it. So, you know, listening to this program helps. Actually doing it helps, and getting involved in some of the gardening programs and master gardener type things that go on around the state really give people some insights as to what it takes to produce the food that we consume.
Well, and the corn may be available in the store, but it has no flavor.
I've never bought it. I refuse to buy it.
It's been about 10 years since I last bought corn in the store, and I thought, I'll never do that again.
No, so. And that's exactly right. And I just wait until the corn guy comes to town and has it, and then I just go like every other day and buy corn, and I do that, and when it's done, it's done, and that's that. So, but the farmer wants to have it earlier because they know the customers like to have a diverse range of products, and just like I like to eat a diverse range of foods each week, our garden can help us do that. So, you know, get out there, and if you haven't planted spinach, if you haven't planted some lettuce and some of these other things, got your carrots in the ground, seeded your beets, done your radishes, all of those kinds of things, then, you know, you can still do that and still get something out of it. But if you did it a month ago when we talked about it, you're that much farther along, because I've had a bunch of people come to me, oh, we listened to your program, we went out and did it. Man, I'm eating such lovely salads out of my garden already. I was eating radishes this week, and they were, you know, about the size of, a little bit bigger than your thumbnail, and they just tasted so good. And, you know, he was just really excited that, you know, they had, you know, kind of taken the risk. And really it was kind of a risk, though we talk about it every year. And if you do some extraordinary things, put some row cover over top of it, you know, maybe use some plastic and kind of make little tunnels out in your garden. You know, all of those things pay off, because we know that the plants that we recommend to plant at this time can withstand the cold that we just had this past weekend. And do fine. They're acclimated to it. The difference between a corn plant and a radish plant is, you know, it's how it responds to temperature. And the two are very, very different. And the one can take all the cold you throw at it and still thrive. And the other one says, boy, I really don't like to be out here. And so I'm not going to grow. And I may not even perform very well, or I may die as a result of being exposed to these cool conditions or the frosty conditions for, you know, any period of time.
Well, and the reverse is also true, which is why I don't usually plant radishes, because they just get too pithy and hot, and I plant them too late. So this year I still didn't plant any radishes, but the greens have just been
phenomenal.
Lovely. Yeah. Just lovely.
And he, you know, he was just saying that, you know, they weren't hot. They were just, you know, they had that nice flavor that you would expect, you know, and it was mild. It was a little spicy. It wasn't unbearable. And he just said, oh, it was just so lovely to have these salads. And they were simple salads, just some greens and a little bit of this stuff in it. And he was particularly impressed with his arugula this year, because he said we didn't have a lot of problems with flea beetles and those kinds of things. So
yeah, they're all over at my house.
Oh, are they over at your house? Okay, well, because those can be a real nuisance. And, you know, he just said that, boy, that peppery flavor and then the nice lettuces and some spinach and that, and then just some oil and vinegar on it to make this nice dressing. He says, you know, it's just been a treat to eat this stuff.
So now that'll be a question for Diane next week, but I'm going to ask you anyway. So what do you do with your arugula? It's like I have this huge garden. I haven't planted a whole lot in it yet, and it's all tilled. Here's this one little section with greens in it. Where do the flea beetles come from? My neighbors don't have arugula. I have arugula. They're all in my yard.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is with with them. I kind of use it as a trap crop, and you know, I know things. They get into everything, and I'm worried about them with the brassicas, because, you know, arugula is in that larger family of plants. Mm. And so they come kind of get to radishes, which is in that larger family of plants as well. And so, you know, that they are voracious feeders, and then they're just literally tons of them.
And you can't smash them. You try to get
to them, and they
jump right away.
As soon as they see you, they jump, and they're gone. And you know, spraying for them can work. We've tried row covers, you know, but they just get underneath the row covers because they seem to be attracted to the aromas, I think, of those plants. And they're just devastating. And I, you know, don't know what to tell anyone when it comes to how do you control these.
Well, I'm experimenting with BT because they do have chewing mouth parts. Yeah. We're like, okay, caterpillars have chewing mouth parts. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll take care of
a lot of the beetles don't respond very well to BTs, but... You know, you can go to, you know, the seven type things. But I'm kind of the mindset, I really don't like to, you know, use pesticides that much in my home garden anyway. It's kind of one of those things that
especially on a leafy green, you're going to be eating the plant itself.
And so, okay, they feed on it a little bit. And if it's, you know, it's got some hole shots in it. I'm less worried about that, you know, really. You know, wash it off good and... You know, eat it, you know.
I do notice that, I also planted some cabbage a week and a half ago, and some of them are late season cabbages, but some of those are like the bok choy, and the flea beetles have gone right to the bok choy. They haven't touched the other stuff yet.
Yeah, so. And I think they're just some of those tender ones. I think in the cabbages, the waxes on the leaf are pretty thick, and it's... You know, that's not as attractive feeding site, whereas the bok choys don't have hardly any wax on them at all. And so they always seem to come to those. And it's just like there's this window for like 2 or 3 weeks where those things are just devastating. And, you know, you get your arugula up, you get your bok choy in the ground, and you think to yourself, I've got this cased, and then all of a sudden the flea beetles show up for about 3 weeks and they just do their business and eat like crazy, and then you don't see them anymore. And so Diane next week, ask her more about it, because you know it's one of those interesting insect pests that, you know, is just a narrow window. And so sometimes, like, if you planted them this week, you probably would find that, you know, by the time those plants are up and out of the ground and starting to grow, the beetles are gone, so they're not going to be a problem.
But if I plant arugula now, it's just going to kind of
that's kind of one of the problems, yeah, because if we turn into some hotter conditions, it really doesn't like those hotter conditions. You're right.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. If you'd like to join our conversation, you got to get a call in quick, 1-800-826-1495. Online at upr.org by clicking on the Programs tab and going to Access Utah. Or you can send us a tweet to us with hashtag AUGarden. So right now we'll hear the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back with Dan Drost, Utah State University's Extension Vegetable Specialist, until 10 o'clock. So stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. Everyone recognizes birdwatchers by their binoculars. Bird listening, on the other hand, takes nothing more than your ears and attention to nature's sounds. Listening for bird songs may require your concentration at first, but soon it becomes second nature. Some common birds of Utah are more easily found and known by their song than their appearance. The canyon wren is one of my favorites. This tiny cinnamon brown bird weighs little more than a marshmallow, but it belts out a cascading song big enough to reverberate off the rocky cliffs and slopes that are its home. You may not see the canyon wren, but try conversing with it by whistling its song in reply. Listen year-round for its song throughout Utah and our neighboring states, particularly in canyons with rocky walls. Nocturnal birds are seldom seen, but commonly heard. Owls are an obvious example, but so is the common porwill, a migrant whose call is diagnostic throughout Utah. Porwills are camouflaged ground nesters. On summer evenings, though, you may occasionally see them settled on pavement, their eyes reflecting headlight beams looking like glowing coals. Birdsong can help distinguish between related bird species, too. On the eastern Great Plains, both eastern and western meadowlarks co-occur. The plumage of these two starling-sized species is nearly identical, but their songs differ dramatically. The eastern species sings but a few clear notes, but our western meadowlark sings a beautiful musical warble. Meadowlarks reside here year-round, typically in grassy areas, pastures, and foothills. Their backs are brown, but the male's chest is a brilliant lemon yellow. Males are frequently seen singing their cheerful song atop a fence post. And that is another reason for listening to birds, for the sheer pleasure of their song. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Sam Winward, agent for New York Life Insurance Company, specializing in estate and retirement planning and insurance needs for businesses and individuals. Online at winwardfinancial.com.
Welcome back to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we'd like to have your question or comments at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question by going to our website at upr.org and clicking on the Programs tab to get to Access Utah. And then, of course, you can send us a tweet by pound, I guess it's hashtag. I always look at it and say pound. Hashtag AU Garden. We'll see if we get our first question that way. So, Dan, we've been talking about what you should do to prepare your soil. If you want to warm the soil up a little bit, can you use a thermometer, just a regular meat thermometer?
You can. The biggest problem that I see with some of these instantaneous reading type thermometers is that they have in their kind of small computer program that's in it, or in the programming that they use, they may not read low enough temperatures. If our soil is 40 degrees and you stick your thermometer in it and the thermometer says it reads between 70 and 350 or 70 and 450 degrees, you see,
you're
that
stuck.
Gives you a problem. You stick it in there and you go, oh, my soil's 70 degrees, when in actuality it's only 40 degrees. So if you do use one of these, make sure that it has sufficient temperature range. And it should say somewhere on the packaging. And if it doesn't say on the packaging, certainly try to find that information out before you purchase one, because you want to be able to read down so that the minimum temperature we kind of say for most of our cool season crops for them to start to germinate is around 40 degrees. So you want to be able to get at least to that 40 degree mark. And for our warm season veggies like cucumbers and squash and bean and corn, their temperature range is in that 60 degrees, that where they really start to germinate most effectively. So you want to be able to get one that works within the appropriate ranges, and they work good other than that. So I have one that I kind of use. We have some that we take measurements in the greenhouses with, and in our tunnels with, and out in our field with, because we kind of use them as a gauge to help us determine when we're going to do things. And then certainly when you start using plastics, as we described, black plastic, you know, it takes some time for the heat to get down in the soil. You kind of want to know you're in or above that ideal temperature range for that particular crop. You know, and that may take a couple days. So some people think, well, I'll put the plastic down and I'll plant immediately. Well, and then they don't see the kinds of responses that they want. A, the response may be the crop comes up rather haphazardly. So some are germinating, some aren't. Some are coming into leaf, some are still just germinating. And that has a lot to do with, you know, just how different plants respond, whereas if they were in a warmer environment, they become much, much more uniform. So that's an important thing for us to kind of consider.
So when you're talking about the cucurbit family, so cucumbers, melons, what is the ideal soil temperature?
Well, ideally, most of the time we would say that germination will start at around 70 degrees pretty effectively, 80 degrees quite rapidly. But for something like if you grow seedless watermelon, they actually germinate best at around 90 degrees. And so, you know, that's pretty tough to get in the vegetable
yeah.
garden.
Yeah.
And that's why we often raise them from transplants and we put them on a heating pad or we put them in a chamber that we can raise the temperature up to those high, high levels.
Or create a little greenhouse out in the garden.
You could do all of those types of things. And what that does is that just makes that seed germinate that much more quickly. Because when a plant has to go through a warm period and then overnight it gets colder again and the soil cools off and then it goes through the warm thing, you know, those slowing periods are what actually drive how that plant's going to develop, because that's really below the optimal zone that we would like to be in, and the plant responds negatively to that. So it just slows up its whole process, and it may have damage to the cell. And if we think about a cell, we're thinking about kind of like a power plant. You know, it has to take energy from someplace, and it has to convert it into other compounds that fuel the growth and development of the plant. Well, if the power plant doesn't get enough fuel, you know, it doesn't run very efficiently, and it needs temperature to run efficiently. It needs good temperatures. And we often see when we're planting early or we're just planting them out in the garden without any extra protection that the temperatures often are just much too slow and they germinate slowly. And then we say, well, they're not all coming up. I wonder why that is. It's not probably the seed's fault. It's probably just it's too cold for them to do that. And so they rot or they just don't function well as a result of being exposed to these colder conditions.
Well, if your temperatures in the daytime are only getting up to 70, 75 and you're dropping down to 45 at night, it's kind of hard to get your soil temperature up to
That's true. But we have to remember also that soil is, you know, our soils are dark colored, and dark colored things tend to warm up more. So it's like putting your hand on the hood of a black car versus the hood of a white car. You can tell those temperature differences. And then it also has to do with the moisture content that's in that as well, because if you have a lot of moisture in your soil, you know, it takes a lot of energy from the sun to heat up that water. It's like, you know, that's why we have stoves. And, you know, it doesn't come instantaneously to a boil. There's a lot of energy that has to go into that. And so if we have really wet soils, they don't heat up as fast. And if we have heavy soils that have lots of clays and silts and those kind of things in them, they tend to hold more water, so therefore they warm up more slowly as well. Whereas sandy soils, which don't hold as much water, also heat up more as a result and heat up more quickly simply because it has to do with the moisture content.
Well, this question from someone online kind of
yeah.
fits right into this. Sarah, I'm not sure where she's writing from, says, my broccoli and cauliflower are turning yellow. Is this because of all the rain? Well, I know in my garden I haven't had that much rain, but it has been still cool.
Yeah, it has to do with probably two things. You know, if you are in an area where we've gotten some rain and the state hasn't been excessively wet, I would suspect that it has less to do with that than it has to do with it's still pretty cold. The soils are not warming up as quickly as we can, and then our overnight temperatures are still quite cool, and the plant just is less efficient at at taking up the nutrients that it needs, and that as a result, these plants suffer. You know, the root system isn't growing out into the soil as rapidly as we would expect, and then the plant tends to cannibalize nutrients that are in the older leaves and moves them to the newer, younger leaves that are trying to grow, and you get this yellowy tinge that shows up, or you'll get a purpling in the color of the leaf, and those are indicators of a little bit of plant stress. And so one of the approaches she may want to take with them, you know, is to, you know, put a floating row cover or something like that over them. It protects them more at night. The temperature stays a little warmer. The air around the plant will get a little warmer during the day, and that can help with those. And then the other thing is, as it warms up, those plants will just start to grow out of that discoloration. You may see some of those older leaves that are kind of yellowish senesce and die off, and that's part of the normal process as well.
Okay, so if you're looking at those types of vegetables, it's not like they need anything, any more nutrients. It's just that they can't get
They can't they can take get them it. Up. So you can water more, and you put cold water on the ground. It just cools it off more. The plant doesn't take it up any better. You can put more nutrients to the plant, but if the plant isn't absorbing things, you know, it doesn't pay it to do that. It's better to get them established, and once we start seeing them starting to grow, then if you need to side dress some additional nutrients on there, then that's the time to do it. And usually we say don't, you know, feed them when we transplant them, you know, wait 2 or 3 weeks and then start feeding them, because then their root system is starting to grow out into the soil, and then they want to take up those extra nutrients. And then by providing them, you're giving them the food that they need so that they can grow vigorously.
Okay, so while we're talking about broccoli and cabbages, so when you're buying them in the store, how do you know the plants are too old? For instance, with cauliflower, if you have bought plants that have been sitting there for a while, sometimes you end up with a cauliflower that's maybe the size of a pencil eraser, because they're just too old.
Yeah.
And the plant's already decided, okay, this is all I can do this year.
Yeah. I think the key with broccoli and cauliflower, even they're more critical because we're actually getting the development of reproductive type structures. That's what we want to consume. The broccoli head is a pre-floral tissue, you know, or, you know, getting floral buds is what we're consuming. The same with a cauliflower. They are particularly sensitive to stresses. The brassica family of plants, which these are in, if we get them beyond about the 6 to 8 leaf stage, the plants change over from growing as what we call juvenile type plants to growing as generative type plants. Now, a juvenile plant is one that is between, young, and you could think of them like our teenagers. But once we get up to about that 6 to 8 leaf stage, they transition, and now what they want to do is either produce the flower structure, in the case of broccoli and cauliflower, or they really want to start heading. And if we get those plants and purchase them and they're too big, they don't have enough time to establish themselves before they transition strongly into that flowering mode or into that heading mode. And then they produce premature flower structures, or they produce little tiny cabbage heads, which frustrates the gardener. So when I look for those plants in the nurseries and garden centers, if I'm not going to grow my own, I tend to try and buy the youngest looking plant that I can find. 4 leaves, maybe 5 leaves at the best. If they're great big tall plants, the older leaves are starting to shed off on them, they look like they have been under some stress, those are plants that generally don't fare very well in our vegetable garden. They don't perform very well, and they just frustrate us as gardeners. So look for young plants, not old plants. 4 leaf stage is about right. If you're growing your own plant, to get it up to about 4 leaves takes about 6 to 8 weeks, depending on what your temperatures are. And that's the ideal key time to transplant those, because then once they get into the ground, they want to grow vigorously.
So then there's not a whole lot you can do at that point. I know with broccoli, you can get some side shoots, but you never do get the big head.
That's
cauliflower,
right.
You're stuck.
You're stuck. You really, cauliflower is a real tricky one anyway because it really likes to grow in cooler type conditions. You know, its optimal temperature range is about 60 to 75, and when we get over that, and we get over that, believe me, then they kind of just shut down, and the first thing that they want to do is, you know, go reproductive. And that's a bad thing for them because, you know, if you don't have a very big plant and it goes reproductive, we call that buttoning or, you know, premature heading, and it produces something that's like a mini cabbage or a mini cauliflower or a mini broccoli head. And, you know, it's certainly not enough for us to eat. It should grow a large head like we buy when we get it in the grocery store. And our environment, particularly for cauliflower, is really not that conducive to its growth.
Hmm.
Just a little too warm during the day, a little too dry. It likes a little bit more humid. And, you know, the only ways we can kind of do those things is to, you know, try to nurse it along, get it started early. But then it's also, it tends to be somewhat sensitive to cold. And so if we plant it out too early, then it responds to that as well, and it wants to flower somewhat prematurely.
Talk about a namby-pamby plant.
It's a namby-pamby plant, yeah. And so long time ago, I gave up on it, you know, and my dad would never grow it in the garden. He just said, it's just too hard to grow. You know, it's just not, you know, it's not a fun plant. Broccoli is much, much more forgiving. And so, you know, I focus my attention more on that plant than I would on cauliflower in our environment here.
Okay. I want an answer to this question. It's kind of one of those trivia questions. I'd never thought of it until just now. If you let broccoli plants, cauliflower plants go, you see the seed heads.
Right.
How does a cabbage plant produce? How does it get the seed?
How does this cabbage? That's a really good question. It's the broccoli plant is a true annual. All of the varieties that we have are true annuals that we tend to grow now. In other words, we plant a seed, and it eventually flowers, and it does that all in the same year. Cauliflower is a little bit different. Cauliflower is if you let it grow to the end of the season and you get a cauliflower head, it doesn't produce a true flower until it gets some cold on pre-flower tissue, we call it. Pre-floral tissue is what a cauliflower head is. With cabbage, it's a true biennial. So what you need to do is if you want it to flower and you want to produce some seed from a variety that you have, let's say you have an open pollinated type heirloom. It might have been something that your ancestors brought with you, and you're running out of seed. And you're
Danish
thinking,
ball head, that's been out there for a long time.
That's been out there forever. You know how you produce seed from that if you wanted to collect seed from it? You'd grow it into a cabbage head this year, and then this fall you'd leave it in the vegetable garden and basically cut the head off rather, you know, cut the head in half. You know, kind of parallel to the soil so that you take off the upper cap part of it and then leave it out there all winter long. And then what it does is it gets sufficient cold because that's what biennials need. They need a cold period. And then next spring what it'll do is that growing point will start to elongate and it'll produce a flower stalk and flower.
So I could eat the top half?
So, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. As long as you don't take that growing point out. You know, as you think about the way the central core of a cabbage head, you know, goes up, at the tip of that cabbage, that core is the apex of it where leaves are still coming. But if you put enough cold to it, which the winter will do, then it will flower.
So how did the great-grandparent of our modern-day cabbages flower? I mean, they didn't have someone going out there cutting the tops off. So.
No, but they're they're self-fertile. So once they do flower and a bee comes along and it just kind of transfers pollen around, then you'll get seed on it, and then the seed would fall to the soil. It would germinate. It would grow as a vegetative plant this year, and then the next year it would flower again.
So it would just erupt through the
yes.
head itself. Okay.
Yeah, it splits. It will split or something like that. But commercially what they do is they actually cut the crown of the cabbage head off of it. They call that the crown, the top part. They cut it in half that way so that that flower doesn't stalk doesn't have anything to impede it coming through the cabbage head.
Kind of makes me want to just try it.
Because
I'd never thought
yeah.
about doing that before.
Yeah. It's not that hard. It just takes 2 years.
But cabbage from your garden after it's been cooled a little bit
yeah.
and
tastes much.
We've talked about doing it like carrots, leaving it in the garden and
right.
going out and oh, it's so good.
Much, much sweeter.
Oh, my heavens. I never knew cabbage could be sweet like that.
Yep, yep.
Well, we only have about 7.5 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, I suggest you do it right now at 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah, and you can click and send your question that way. Or go to Twitter and at #AUGarden, you can also send us a question. So I'd like to back up just a little bit and talk about preparing to plant your various like cucumbers, your melons, because I'm going to be ready to go this year.
Yep.
I'm going to get those cantaloupes in. And how many are too many? Like how many seeds would you put in a hill and then thin them down to how many? Because it's so hard for me to thin, but I'm learning to do it. That
yep.
yeah.
Yeah. Well,
it's better
normally
for the plant.
I always say that the least cost to you is the seed itself. Because if you don't have a plant, you don't have a watermelon, right? So I plant a watermelon seed, and if I only plant one of them and it doesn't come up, I got no watermelon. So I always think seed costs are, you know, well worth overseeding and thinning back. So in a head or in a hill of watermelons or in a hill of cantaloupes or something like that, two plants is a good number to have. Three is okay. The more competition, in other words, the more plants you have, the smaller the fruit size is going to be. That tends to be because they're competing with each other for the resources that are there. That's the resources are water and nutrient and space, and all of those things influence how big that fruit is going to get. So generally, I would say 2 to 3 plants per hill, and then it's going to kind of depend on how close your hills are together. So if you and normally we would say for watermelon about 24 inches, for cantaloupes about 24 inches apart, for squashes, some of the big squashes and those kind of things, bananas and all of those, maybe 36 inches apart, the hills, with 2 to 3 plants in each hill, then that fills in that space nicely and you'll get a lot of fruit.
Same with zucchini?
A little closer, probably 18 to 24 inches between those plants.
Only two?
You know,
yeah,
it just
one
depends
produces
on how,
a lot.
It just depends on how many zucchinis you want to get.
Well, and in our house, we tend to pick them quite young,
yeah,
so we'll have we've had up to 10 plants before.
Yeah,
so.
And I know, and you need that many if you're only picking the little fingerling types, yeah.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Bill from St. George. Hi, Bill. How can we help?
Yeah, I just have my tomato plants in the ground for about 3 or 4 weeks now, and I've always heard that coffee grounds can somewhat be good for your garden or for growing vegetables. Is that the case? And if so, is it too late to put those in now or that I have the plants in the ground?
No, it won't hurt. It won't hurt you to put them on there. You have to just remember that it's organic matter. It's just plant tissue. So it's like, you know, if you have a compost pile or I mean, a lot of times we'll have a bucket in the house where I put in the eggshells and I put in whatever trimmings you have off of it, and then it kind of goes out every day into a compost pile. Your coffee grounds go into that as well. You know, whether it supplies specific nutrients to the plant, I don't think anybody has really studied it closely to say, yeah, coffee grounds make your tomatoes taste sweeter, make the fruit grow bigger. It's not going to do any of those. So spreading them around out in the garden isn't going to hurt at all. So go to it. Rather than sending them to the landfill, you know, it's just saving space in the landfill, and they eventually decompose there as well. So you might as well put them back into your soil. And you guys down in St. George, your soil needs all the organic matter it can get. So, you know, start a compost pile.
Okay, great. And one other question
sure.
on setting the blossoms on the tomatoes. Is that a worthwhile effort, or just let them go as they come on and
Let them go.
You get more productivity out of a tomato.
By pruning them off, you just get less production. So.
Setting them.
Did you say setting or cutting?
Setting.
Oh.
Setting.
Well, they set pretty natural. I mean, the only time we run into problems with setting on tomato is if we're growing them in a greenhouse or in a tunnel. Then they don't the actual wind action blowing the plant during the day causes the flower to vibrate, and that vibration of the flower causes the anther sac, or the part that has the pollen in it, to shed. So as the flower matures, the vibrations by just the wind blowing through it causes the plants to naturally shed pollen. And so you should be getting them set pretty well. The only time you run into problems down south is when the temperatures start to get up into the mid to upper 90s, because they don't set very well at very high temperatures. And even if you try to help set them, they don't do that well just because the temperature is too high.
So just leave well enough alone.
Yeah, you know, don't you know, go play golf or something.
There you go. You got it.
Yeah, you know, do something else, because the tomato will take care of itself. You've got it in the ground. It's growing vigorously. You're watering it like it's supposed to, you know, and then let it do its thing.
Okay.
All right?
Well, that sounds easy. I appreciate your help on
that.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Just real quickly, in the last 65 seconds or so, I want to talk about supports for tomatoes. Mm-hmm. It seems like in the past, you've seen those little metal cages. I hate those things.
Yep.
I hate them.
Okay.
I've started using them for my dahlias, you know, turning them upside down
right.
and that kind of stuff. What do you usually put a tomato on? Because the plants get big, and if a wind comes along, those little cages just blow right over.
Well, there are some bigger, heavy-duty types that are out there. They're pretty expensive.
You're like $18.
Yeah, you know, and then you say to yourself, you know, you can go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy 1x2-inch kind of lath-type material. I cut those in half, and I pound one of those in right next to a plant, and then just tie the plant to that. You know, you've got a 4-foot-tall stake. You put about 18 inches in the soil, so that means you got about 2.5 feet, and it holds it up pretty nice. Or you can, you know, if you have all your tomatoes in a row, you just put one of those stakes every other plant, you just tie string around it, and they will stand up much, much better. And I find that works well. Some people use hog fence, you know, that heavy-duty fence that you'd grow.
Yeah.
And then just tie them up to that, and that
like
helps.
You would use, like I use that for my peas.
Right, so. And you could just switch it over to your tomatoes when your peas are done.
Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost, Utah State University's Extension Vegetable Specialist, has been my guest. Stay tuned for Access Utah Gardening again next Monday, and we'll be back.
Frame up a bit of living art to brighten a wall, soften a hard surface, or add a focal point to your outdoor living space. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Owners of Distinctive Gardens converted a picture frame into a bit of living art. This small, easy-to-construct green wall will fit in any landscape, large or small. Start with a shadow box or other deep display box or picture frame. Drill some holes in the bottom for drainage and on top for watering. Then fill with a well-drained potting or succulent mix, depending on the plants you'll be growing. Incorporate a slow-release fertilizer at planting. Cover the potting mix with a piece of weed barrier to hold the soil in place. Cut X's in the fabric where succulents, sedums, and other small-scale plants will be placed. Anchor the weed barrier in place with the frame or staples. Hang your living artwork in the proper amount of sunlight for the plants you're growing, and water thoroughly as needed. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.